Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. My name is James Wren. I'm a senior consultant with Microsoft Services, and I'm going to be going over how to simplify unit testing with PEXAMOLS today. So to get started, how many of you used unit testing? It's good, about 30%. And how many of you use a unit testing framework, like mock, RhinoMock? A couple? Okay. So this will build off of that. The agenda for the presentation is, first we're going to talk about unit testing, what it is, why we do it. Next we're going to look at the unit testing tools built into Visual Studio. Visual Studio has a rich suite of tools built in, so it's pretty painless to get into unit testing and really just to get into the habit of it. Next we're going to look at MOLES. It's an isolation framework to isolate your code from external dependencies. So if your code depends on a database or if it depends on a SharePoint, MOLES is there so that you can write unit tests that don't require you to have a SharePoint server running or have a database. Next, we're going to look at PEX automated white box testing. This one is pretty cool, and it's new out of Microsoft Research. And it'll automatically generate inputs for you, and it'll analyze your code. So to get started, unit testing, what is it? The classical definition is a unit test is a piece of code that invokes another piece of code and checks the correctness of some assumptions afterwards. If the assumptions turn out to be wrong, the unit test has failed. A better definition is that a unit test is fast, in memory, consistent, automated, and repeatable test of a functional unit of work in the system. And that unit of work is any functional scenario in the system that contains logic. So from this, we're saying that these should be run very quickly. Often, if you have source control, if you're doing continuous integration, when you check in, it can download the latest from the trunk, run all the unit tests, verify that you didn't change something somewhere and break something else. What unit testing is not, it is not F5. It must be automated. You can't hit F5, run to see that it worked, change the input, run it again, see that it worked. The idea is that you write these tests and you save them so that at a later date, when you make other changes, you can run through all the tests that you've already written to verify the correctness of your code. And it does not utilize external dependencies. As I said, you can't involve a database in unit test. You can't involve the file system. Those come into integration testing, not unit testing. So what are the qualities of a good unit test? A unit test must be readable with clear pre- and post-conditions. They should be as simple as possible, but no simpler. Only test one thing. Often, unit tests should be like 8 or 9 lines of code. Sometimes 4 or 5. So they shouldn't be really big functions or functions calling other functions. They should be very simple and very direct. They should also be fast. If you have a large project, if you're doing continuous integration, you may have hundreds, thousands of unit tests. And if you're going to run on every check and you want them to run quickly. And really, if your unit tests take 10 minutes to run, nobody's going to run them. And then what was the point? Finally, a good quality of a unit test is that they run in isolation of each other and that they don't rely on another to test. You shouldn't be able to run one unit test and that impact the results of another unit test. When I go over Visual Studio unit testing, we'll see that it randomizes the order of your unit tests that run to make sure that they're not depending on each other. So why do we do it? Even world-class programmers make mistakes. One reason is to increase confidence in the correctness of the code. Run unit tests after every check-in to verify that you did not break anything. It also reduces panic. The more time you spend writing tests, running tests, the less bugs your system will have, and the less bugs will get reported back to you. So instead of fixing bugs, you'll be writing and running tests. And when you fix bugs and check them in, you'll be able to run your unit test suite and verify that nothing else was broken from your fix. Much less time will be spent on integration. Individual components, when they're unit tested, they'll have clear inputs and clear outputs. If you put a bad input into one component, you should know what happens when that bad input goes in, rather than some kind of chaotic behavior. Maybe it'll return null, maybe it'll blow up. It'll be very clear. And the earlier a bug is caught, the easier and cheaper it is to fix. And that seems pretty straightforward. If you catch the bug, it's really easy to fix. If testing catches it, they have to send emails and get you involved. If a client catches it, it may have to go through support, back to test team, reproduce it. So the earlier you catch them, it's much, much better. There was an experiment by Glenn Myers where experienced programmers were testing a program with 15 known defects. The average programmer found only 5 of the 15 errors, and the best programmer found 9. That still leaves 6 unprocessed errors, not found errors. So we're not computers. We can't go through all the logic and find everything. So that's where unit tests come into play to help us catch these bugs. And the main source of the undetected errors was erroneous output that wasn't carefully examined enough. A couple terms for unit testing. The first is stubs. These are objects that act as a control point to deliver indirect input to the system under test. They allow us to exercise code paths that might otherwise be unreachable in test. Often, there'll be an object that the system that you want to test, it calls methods in that object, and it'll usually be behind the interface. So when you come time to test, you can put your stub object in place of the real object and then deliver inputs in that way. Mocks are similar, but they're used to determine whether the unit test has passed or failed by verifying that the system under test interacted as expected with the mock object. So for example, for a mock, if you had a method in your mock, you could have, in your mock object, you could have a Boolean flag that if that method's called, it sets true that that method was called. And then you can assert that your class did indeed call that method. And we'll get into this more when I go do a demo with Visual Studio testing. Stubs and mocks, it's a little confusing because a lot of test frameworks keep them as the same object. Moles does it, mock does it. I think they're separate in RhinoMock. But a good way to remember it is that a stub can never fail a test. The assert is always performed on the mock object. So here's an example of a unit test. Like I said, they're very short, they're very small. And there's three steps: arrange, act, and assert. Here we see we're setting the capacity, the element. Act is where we create our array list and add the element. And then assert is where we assert something about the system that should be true after the test is run. So I mean, this is a pretty basic test of if you add an element, it will be the first element in an array. Unit testing is integrated into Visual Studio. I really like it. I've used a couple frameworks, but the integration makes it really easy to work with. It's also, if anyone's using Team Foundation Server for source control or for bugs, it just integrates with that whole suite. It'll, like all the frameworks, it'll automatically detect and execute unit tests. The one in Visual Studio is good because it'll look through your entire solution rather than like at certain assemblies. And the thing I really like about it is you can run tests in debug mode. So if something's going wrong, you can just run the test in debug, throw in a breakpoint, break on exception, whatever you need to go in and examine the code. It'll also report code coverage, which is important when we get into PEX, because one of the goals with PEX is to get 100% code coverage. And I want to note that PEX and Moles will work with other testing frameworks in .NET, so you're not limited to Visual Studio. You can use NUnit, XUnit. So I'm going to do a demo of testing in Visual Studio. Are there any questions on that first part? So we'll create a new project, and we'll call it Calculator. Our class we called Calculator, and we'll have one simple method in here called divide. Okay, really simple, really basic. Can everyone see that okay? Bump it up to about there. It's better. Okay. Now to add a test in Visual Studio, right-click, create unit tests. Finds it for the method. We'll tell it to put it in a new project. And we'll name the project calculator.tests. That's what we use on our project. Moles will, when it creates test projects, it does the project name.tests. So I think it's a good standard to go with. So we're not going to get into some of the advanced features up there of it, but we do see that it made a sample test down here. It's a little wordy, but again, it does break it up into the arrange, act, and assert. I'm going to clear this out. Right now, it's just asserting inconclusive. So we have our target. vector will act, so we'll do target divide 6 by 3. And then we'll assert r equal, and 6 divided by 3 is 2. So we'll do that. That's our unit test. Very, very simple, very concise, testing the correctness of our function. You right-click, you can do run tests. It'll find them, it'll run them, and it passed. When we get into this view of the test results, you can double-click on the tests, and it'll show you the results. This might be more useful for the test team than for the developers. And one kind of cool thing, I think, is if you do a console write line in your test, and then run the test, if you click on it, it'll show you the standard console out right there. So if you end up having a really complicated test, you can print out a bunch of information, and you can look at it after. So another thing we can do is write negative tests. So we'll do a divide 0. We'll divide by 0. So a range. We'll divide 6 by 0. And what I'm expecting to happen is that it will throw an exception, type of divide by 0 exception. So this method is, Visual Studio Test is going to verify that when you run this, a divide by zero exception is thrown. We run this test, it turns out it fails. So I'll demonstrate how you can debug in and be like, well, why did this not blow up? We go in there, just hit debug. It'll run in the test. And if we look here, we can see the result is infinity. So the CLR actually by default returns infinity rather than exploding when you try and divide by zero. So that may not be the behavior that I want or that the specification asks for. So we'll go in here. And if divisor equals zeros, then we'll throw the new divide by zero exception. And as I was talking about earlier, when you unit test, you get a more clearly defined input and output to these, especially when bad input is given. Often you'll test that it works for this, or it works for that, but then you won't test that, well, what happens if I throw in garbage? And even though we may assume like this would blow up, now we have a test that knows, oh, it actually returns infinity, so we can correct that and make it have like our expected behavior. And if we run this again, it'll show you that it does pass. Finally, we're going to look at code coverage. So if we go into test, edit test settings, and for the local settings. There's also, this thing, there's a lot of knobs and things you can turn on this thing. We're just going over a pretty small chunk of it. We can enable code coverage and turn it on for calculator. And then we'll run all tests in the solution. On the right, it was a little bit hidden. You can see show code coverage results. If we go into here, it'll show you the DLL, how many blocks weren't covered, how many blocks were covered. So this is good. We have 100% code coverage. And we can also do is double-click in, and it'll highlight the areas that were covered. If there were areas that were not covered, those will be highlighted in red. Are there any questions on that part? I'm not sure. I'm guessing when this gets translated to MSIL, there's like five statements, and it's seeing if each of those statements are hit.
Is this 2010 only, or?
This has been around since 2008, or I think it's in 2005 also. It's going to be in Team System or Visual Studio Ultimate, though. It doesn't. I'm not sure if it's in Professional. I know it's not on the basic. It's in Professional. Okay. Anything else?
Could you create a hierarchy of tests and group them by actions like dependent on success and failure? It's sort of like testing GDAL.
Could you repeat that? Sorry.
Can you repeat the integrate hierarchies of test case of unit test cases? Run them like in certain conditions, like dependencies or success, failure of a previous test, and create test suites. Sort of like test MG does.
Okay, I haven't used that. The question was if you can create hierarchies of unit tests and kind of run them and group them based on certain conditions. I don't think so. And this, I could be wrong. We haven't done it on my project. So I can get back to you on that. So next we're going to look at moles. You use moles to isolate your code. Think of it as an isolation framework. And it's going to, repeating myself, it's going to isolate your code from external dependencies. It's going to do two things. It'll generate stub objects for every interface or class with overridable methods. This is good if you're going to use stubs for unit testing, but you don't want to have to create your own. Moles will create them for you. When the interface changes, it'll automatically update the object. So it just saves you the effort of hand-rolling your own. The second thing, which is unique to moles and I think is really cool, is it will create objects that you can use to detour around hard-coded dependencies. For example, if you have a huge app and it's Y2K and you want to test that your app won't crash when the clock switches to the year 2000, you could replace the behavior of datetime.now to test that rather than having to change it in the clock. And with moles, you can replace almost any method in .NET. Static, sealed, private, static constructors. You can even change the behavior of finalizers if you want. So again, the two types of moles, there's stub types and mole types. Stub types, like I said, are going to be generating stubs for you that you could have rolled your own. And they're named with S plus the name of the type. Next are the mole types, and these are hard coding or detouring around hard-coded dependencies. Under the hood, it's going to use the profiling API, which is the same API that the debugger uses to attach the process, to use breakpoints. So there will be some additional overhead. And these are named M plus the name of the type, so mole type and subtype. The mole types become really useful when you start looking at SharePoint or testing ASP.NET applications, where a lot of the objects require a live connection. It would be a ton of work to create a wrapper around the request object so that you could put a stub type in behind it when you're testing. So you can use the mole type to just go in and change the behavior of HTTP request, of server, anything that you want. And if you go on to the documentation on the link below, it has specific guides for SharePoint and ASP.NET using moles to get around those dependencies. The naming conventions are pretty intuitive. It works at an assembly level, so for whatever assembly you pointed to, it'll be that assembly.moles.dll. If your namespace is system, it'll be system.moles now for the moles classes. When you look at a moles class, when you're going to override a method with a delegate, it's going to be named the method plus the first argument type plus the second argument type for the unique method signature, property get, property set. And for the mole type, you can use .all instances to replace the behavior of every instance of a class. So we're going to get into the moles demo now. And we'll pick up where we left off with our calculator. We'll create a method that has a dependency on the file system. So what this method is going to do is you pass it an array of files, and it's going to sum up the size of all of them for you. As I said before, you can't unit test it if it has a dependency on the file system. That would be an integration test. So there's two ways we can handle this. You can use stubs, which is the traditional way, and I'll show you that first, and then I'll show you how you can do it with mole types. So when you're going to use stubs, the idea is to create a wrapper that encapsulates your dependency and then expose its methods through an interface. When it comes time to test it, you'll create a stub that also implements the interface, put the stub in place of the wrapper, and then you can test your code without having to worry about the external dependency. So that's what we're going to do here. So we're going to create an I file service. have one method, getSize. And then we'll create our implementation. So it's wrapping the dependency on the file system. Now for our calculator class to use it, it's going to have a local reference to its file service. And then instead of calling file info directly, it's going to return files.sum. So it's a decent amount of code. So now that we have this generated and we want to test it, I'm going to show you how to do that with moles. So it's really, really easy. We'll right-click here, add moles assembly. Build the project. And we see calculator.moles has been added. Remember the naming convention. This is the moles classes for the calculator assembly. If we double click on this and dive in, we can see that moles generate a decent number of types. The S is for the stub classes and M is for the mole classes. So the SI file service is going to be your stub that implements the file service. So now when we get into the tests, we can create another test method. There we go. And now we can set delegates that will have the behavior of the method. So we're going to set a delegate for the getSize, and it takes in a string. So that's going to be, as we talked about the naming convention before. And we'll put in a lambda expression here, so that now when the file service is called to get the size, it'll just return a size of 1. Set up our calculator again, and instead of using its default implementation for the file service, we'll pass in our stubbed file service. Now we'll act. We'll just pass in some dummy values. And finally, we'll assert. That the result is 4. We test it around this, and hooray, it passes. So as you can see, it's a decent amount of work. And it depends usually on kind of the project, like if you want to go this route. It's usually the recommended route. And often, if you're using dependency injection, there's other cases where you're going to want to create your services behind interfaces anyway. And you can see with the code highlighting is on that this file service was never called. So now this is in red because that line of code hasn't been tested. So I'm going to show you how to do it with the mole types now. So we can remove that. Oops. We can get rid of this. And we can get rid of all these extra classes. Build it and go back to our test. So we're going to write the test a little differently now. So I need to override two methods. I need to override the constructor for the file info so that it doesn't go to the file system and try and fetch that information. And I need to override the getLength method. So it's pretty easy to so I need to add a moles class for MS Core Lib. So right click here, add moles assembly for MS Core Lib. We build it now. So this is pretty cool. What moles has done is really quickly, it took everything in MS Core Lib, all the types you're used to, all the collections, and it made the mole type and the stub type for them. Here, I was able to use the mole type to just override the runtime behavior of the file info class. We can keep this the same, the result the same, and we'll assert that it's, again, it's four, and we can also assert that it created four file infos. Two things we have to add. We have to change the host type. You don't really have to worry about this. You don't have to understand why you need to do it too much. Visual Studio is going to tell Visual Studio to create a whole different instance, and moles will be in charge of it. And then we also need to set a property. It tells moles that we're moling this type and that it's going to want to override the behavior of it. This is just for performance, because it'd be really expensive to monitor every single type when they're being created and trying to override the behavior. If we flip back, we should now be able to run this test. As you can see, there's some overhead, so it's taking a little longer to start up. But it passed. Are there any questions on using moles?
So that thing that you put in the assembly, does that override anything in the whole project that used the file info class? So you said that that helps performance, but what exactly is that doing?
Oh, okay. The question was why we put that in there, if it's how it's helping performance?
Yeah, is it, it so anytime you project can use file info, is that substitute your file info, the moles, for everything across the project, or?
The question is if now whenever we use file info, is it going to use the moles type instead? And the answer is no. It's only going to use it just for this one test. It needs to know that it's a mole type, just kind of just quirks of how the profiling API is implemented, is for it to start replacing methods as these types are compiled and brought into memory. It has to tell the CLR ahead of time. So if we didn't do this, it would have to tell the CLR for every single type that it could possibly mole, and there's thousands of them. So it just now it only has to tell the CLR about one type. So it's telling the CLR that I might mole this, but I may not.
Is moles built in, or do you have to download it?
You have to download that. I have references at the end. They're both available from MSDN. Moles is a free download. And PEX requires an MSDN subscription. A couple considerations when using moles. It does not have all the features of other mocking frameworks. Keep that in mind. They can easily be added, but when it was created, the goal was not to compete with mock or compete with RhinoMock. The goal was to create an isolation framework to support PEX. And it just turned out to be really, really good. On my project, we're using a hybrid of moles and mock. Mock, like I said, is more features, but we use moles when we need to detour around hard-coded dependencies like static methods. Keep in mind that these moles assemblies are compiled on every build. So if you change one one assembly, I mean, code in one file, it'll have to rebuild the moles assembly. If you have a huge project, this can significantly affect your build times. And it is still under development. It's version 0.94. We've been using it on our project since 0.93, I think. But it's easy to use. It feels mature. We haven't had any problems with it. So I highly recommend it. Next, we're moving on to PEX. PEX is automated unit testing. It uses white box test generation to analyze the code and to generate the inputs. The opposite would be black box testing, where it just throws inputs at it and then records what comes out. With white box, it's going to look at your if statements, your assertions, any operation that can throw an exception to figure out what input it can put in there to try and reach every code path. And it's not going to just keep throwing random values at the code to see that it hits every chunk of the code. What it does is it runs the code multiple times, and it monitors the control in the data flow. After each run, it chooses branches that haven't been covered. It builds a constraint system that describes how to reach each branch, and then it'll kind of play around from there to reach other branches. And it will use a constraint solver to determine new test inputs. Basically, it's sort of machine learning, and it'll figure out your code, and it'll learn what inputs it can put in to try to get to 100% code coverage. Where PEX really begins to shine is when you start looking at parameterized unit testing. The idea of parameterized unit testing is rather than writing individual input and output, you write preconditions and postconditions. When you use PEX is when you want to find the inputs that meet your preconditions, achieve 100% code coverage, and also try to fail your postconditions. An example of this would be right here. So instead of a range act to start, we had another A, which is assume. So this is going to be testing a regular expression that finds an email. So you're assuming that the email that the string passed in contains my email at domain.com and that it's not null. Then you're going to create the regular expression, run it, and then see if it did find that value. So instead of having to generate 20 different inputs, passing them all in, see that it finds all the emails out, we'll just tell PEX, assume that it contains this email, and it'll handle generating all the other inputs. And adding stuff to one side of the string, another side of the string. And what's really cool about PEX is it's smart enough to figure out this regular expression and to make code that will work with it. So now we're on to the PEX demo. I'll create a new project for this one. I don't know where PEX came from. Mole, I guess. I kind of think like the mole is like borrowing. So I already wrote this method. Oh, yeah. So I wanted a somewhat complicated method to demonstrate how PEX kind of keeps trying to get 100% code coverage. This method is to capitalize a string. It's going to take in your string. It's going to see if it's a letter. If it is, then it's going to capitalize it. And the goal is what it's trying to do is capitalize the first letter of each word. It's going to change the punctuation into underscores, and it's going to remove numbers, anything else. So to get started, we'll right-click, and we'll run PEX. Give it a minute, it's still running. It's a little slow because it's the first time it started up. So it finished. You see that it ran through the method 202 times, trying different inputs to try and hit everything that it could. You can see the values that it input here and the results that came out. At first, can everyone see that? I don't know if I can increase the size too easily. All right, well, I'll describe it. So there's a lot of, like, it'll put in an A and it'll get out a capital A. It'll put in an A period, and it'll get it on a capital A underscore. At first, the inputs seem random, but when you look at them a little closer, you see really it's just using the letter A, uppercase and lowercase, a punctuation, and it uses /0 a couple times, which is, I guess, the simplest character we can think of because it's just all zeros. So it found one problem, which is this null reference exception. The .NET guidelines say that a method should never throw a null reference exception. So some people say garbage in, garbage out. The .NET guidelines are you shouldn't be throwing a null reference exception. And the idea is if a higher level component passes bad data to a lower level component, then the higher level component should be prevented from doing so in the first place. So while we can't fix this error, we can move where the code blows up to a higher level of extraction. So we put it at the very beginning of the method. So PEX lets us fix this very easily. We'll just right-click, add precondition. And now it added the if the value is null, then throw the null argument exception. We run PEX again. See that it's happy now. We see that it ran faster. So now that we have these, we can save them as unit tests. We select them all, hit save. We'll create a new project, and you can see it's using that same naming convention of string extensions.tests. And then it creates our test down here. To show you that it did get 100% code coverage, I'll turn on code coverage for this one. So data and diagnostics, enable code coverage, and turn it on for that assembly. Now if we run all tests in the solution, we see that they all passed, and let's see if it's highlighted. Yeah, we see that all this text has been highlighted because it was hit. So let's look at what PEX saved when it got into here. I'll increase it for this one too. So right here is our parameterized unit test for capitalize. Right now it's pretty simple. All it's doing is calling capitalize and then it's returning the result. If we look at the generated file, we see it's created a different method for every input that it tried to put in. So before when I was talking about using parameterized unit testing rather than traditional unit testing, this is where we would go and we would add our assumptions and our assertions. So right here, we can assert that every time this capitalize is run, that you can put the result back through capitalize, and that'll have the same value. And then from here, we can run PEX explorations again. And it'll start generating new inputs, trying to find something that'll make our assertion wrong. And now these are just automatically ended to the end of our inputs. So let me show you another sample. We can define another PEX method. And these in this file is where you're putting your parameterized unit tests. And don't worry too much about the generated files beneath it. So we'll add a test that if you pass in a number, you can't, it strips away the numbers because it's only keeping letters and it's only keeping spacing. Or I mean punctuation, sorry. So here's where we'll do our assumptions. We'll assume the value isn't null. We'll assume that the value contains the number 1. And I want to use the link contains. There we go. So we'll assume we didn't really have anything to arrange. Now we'll act. Now we'll do our assertions. So this is saying, give me strings that have the number one character in them, run it through capitalized, and then the result should not have anything. So this is a lot stronger than creating unit tests that have a one in it and then verifying that the one's been deleted. Now we can say, this is my assumptions, and then this is what will be true after you run it. And we run PEX explorations again. Oh, sorry, I was returning. So we can see that the input that it's generating all has the number one in it. And this is based on the assumption. So PEX was able to, it starts throwing input at the PEX method. It only can use input that has a number one, so it figures that out pretty quickly. And then it starts making inputs to try and go through 100% code coverage of the method. And then when they get out, we test them on the other end. Are there any questions?
Why did it say it only tested 19 out of 21 blocks this time?
It looks like it didn't hit a block, which...
Would that show up in red then?
Yeah, that'll... If I can... Let me delete the old tests. And then save these tests. The reason it only did 19 out of 21 blocks is because we assumed that null wasn't in there. So it wasn't able to hit the test for null and then throw the null reference exception. So it saved those. If I run these tests, and then we jump back to the string extensions.
Right.
Yeah, we see that the null argument exception wasn't hit.
Makes sense.
Good question.
So it has to be hit by each of the generated tests for each of the subtests, I guess.
Yeah, the other one would have hit it, and that's a good question. The question is if every test has to hit all of them, and what I did was to show them that it didn't hit the null. I just deleted all the generated input that was in there, but the first method, the capitalized, is the one that's going to hit for null, and then that'll hit it. So it's hit there. For the no digits, it won't get hit there, but when we run the entire test suite, it'll have 100% code coverage. It's really up to you. I've tested private methods before. I guess it depends on how complicated it is. If they're pretty simple, then maybe just test the external interfaces. But sometimes when they're kind of complicated, when you have threading and like locks going on, then it makes sense to test the private methods. And if you want to, if you're using moles, you can pretty easily replace the behavior of a private method. So if you want to test another private method that calls another private method, you can replace the behavior of that private method and then run the other one. So it gives you a lot of flexibility in how to test it without you having to re-engineer your whole design to support testing it. So a couple considerations for PEX. It's still under development. This is the same version as moles. And there's a decent learning curve, so it'll take a couple hours to get the hang of using it. Also, PEX is pretty smart, but it's not like mathematically complete. Like, it's not going to catch every possible error. So when you run PEX and it doesn't find any issues, don't assume your code is bug-free because PEX didn't catch anything. References for the presentation, that's the project page for PEX. The documentation is on the same spot. Just go to research.microsoft.com and then search for PEX. You can download PEX and moles from MSDN, as I said before. There's no subscription required for moles. PEX does require an MSDN subscription. And if you have any questions or if you want the slide deck even, just send me an email and I'll be happy to answer. Are there any other questions? All right, thank you all.